This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's Tuesday, September 5th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I'm back from vacay, but one item stuck in my craw, making me a bit cray-cray. It's the BRICS. Gotta hit the BRICS again. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. I talked about them before I left, and then they went and added Saudi Arabia, Iran, Egypt, Argentina, Ethiopia, and the United Arab Emirates. Were horrid human rights abuses a prerequisite or just a quirky coincidence? Now, Argentina, they've been relatively clean on that score for decades, but they do have 100% inflation. And I probably don't have to tell you about the Saudis or the Iranians. The Egyptians aren't too much better. But what about Ethiopia? No shade on Ethiopia. And seriously, there is no shade on Ethiopia. But the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, did win the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. Since then, he's been credibly accused of overseeing a campaign of war crimes and ethnic cleansing in prosecuting the war in the Tigray region. I'm putting aside morals, though. I'm just focusing on the economics. This is an economic consortium. Ethiopia has a lower GDP than Idaho. I'm glad it's doing better. Power to the Ethiopians. Hell, power to the South Africans. They have experienced many rolling blackouts over the last couple of years. Listen to how BRICS backers talk about the supposed power, the world-changing power of this grouping.
We know that the BRICS nations were put together by India, Brazil, China, Russia, and some African nations, and it has been growing and growing and growing. I'm going to show you some articles that should be shocking to you, or maybe they're not, because you understand what's going on, and you understand that the dollar is literally dying, and we are now in a world war, economically, literally, between the East and the West.
Yes, the S in BRICS for some African nations. Look, I could pull a clip of a dummy being dumb about any subject, right? But man, was that dumb. He was the Economic Ninja. That was the website that he was on. I need to tell the Economic Ninja, there is literally not a world war going on. There literally is a European war, and that factored into the analysis of fellow BRICS backer Glenn Greenwald.
BRICS, named for its key members Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has been rapidly growing. It would be a clear exaggeration to assert that BRICS is on the verge of replacing the U.S. and NATO and the various neoliberal institutions of the West in exercising hegemony, but every year it is getting closer to doing so. And nothing has fueled the ambitions of BRICS more than the virtually monomaniacal fixation of the U.S. national security state on the war in Ukraine. While the U.S. sends tens of billions of dollars after tens of billions of dollars and depletes its own stockpiles of weaponry and gives away major concessions in order to avoid a humiliating loss to Moscow.
And then BRICS flourishes? Glenn knows the R in BRICS is for Russia. The United States is the one that's maniacally pursuing the war in Ukraine. It's the U.S. that's depleting its stockpiles, throwing away treasure, and diminishing its status over the war in Ukraine. The United States, not the in BRICS. If you want to say BIX is doing okay, well, that's a better point, but doesn't quite get to the level of a good point. BRICS, new members, old members, economic coalition, counter, hegemonic force, ninja level posse. Come on. Come on. Just come on. I know it's not a mainstream opinion, but it is offered enough for me to say this is one of the dumbest takes out there, that BRICS is going to be anything to make anyone in the Western world or rest of the world notice. China is a force. China is a thing. India has lots of people. Iran's, I don't know, they're good at kidnapping Swedes, and I guess that's certainly a thumb in the eye of European hegemony. But you've got to be not just suspicious of the West or skeptical of the Western economic order. You have got to hate, blindingly, distortingly hate the Western Economic Order to look at BRICS as anything other than China, plus some other groupings and collections of people that have a flag and an anthem assigned to them. It's like the Joker and his weird clown henchmen. You know, they don't want to dress up as clowns. They just need the gig. Or it's like the members of Wings not named Paul McCartney. I actually do not wish to insult the striving Brazilians and South Africans or any of the peoples of these countries of the world. And I don't want to insult Wings members Joe English or Jeff Britton. Notice the theme? You don't? It's that their surname is a country that was once the world's greatest empire, is now faded a bit, but didn't embarrass itself by pretending that contributing to a somewhat pithy acronym means they're part of a movement, that they're resetting the world order. To suppose otherwise, you would have to be thick as a, yeah, you know the rest. On the show today, quantifying Qantas's quidness, but first, Republican presidential candidates have been hogging the limelight as of late, what with their debating and being indicted as they do. But the Democrats have a candidate in the 2024 race. He's an elderly Delawarean with a love of muscle cars. His name is Joe Biden. If you've not heard of him, and I bet you have, I will be talking to Franklin Foer up next. He is the author of the just-released book, The Last Politician, Inside Joe Biden's White House and the Struggle for America's Future. We will discuss Biden's relationship with the various factions of his own parties and the accomplishments he'll be running on in 2024. Frank Foer, up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Joe Biden, son of Scranton, sentimentalizer of the Senate, second fiddle of a transformative presidency, but then what? Well, you know, he became president. And how we experience Joe Biden is, of course, through the medium of television or social media. But having read Franklin Foer's new book, The Last Politician, I've come away with the theory that if we experienced current events, or at least the presidency, mostly in print form, Joe Biden would be on a glide path to re-election and have an approval rating of at least 60%. I don't know. It is still America. But so many of the flaws and foibles of Joe Biden seem to be of a presentational level. When you get down into the substance, as Franklin Foer did, there's a lot of accomplishment there. But not all. It's not all roses. There are mistakes along the way. He chronicles them. He joins us now. Frank, welcome back to The Gist.
Pleasure to be here.
This was the book that needed to be written, I guess. Why did you want to write it?
Well, I wasn't sure exactly what I was getting into. I signed up for this in the fall of 2020 when it looked plausible that Joe Biden might be president. And I thought I was going in to chronicle the nation's to chronicle a presidency that was battling a pandemic, trying to save the economy from falling off a cliff, and dealing with the ruins of the Trump presidency. And my publisher wanted me to write what is the cliche book, which is the book about the first 100 days of a presidency. Now, as an author in my heart, I knew that was a trope. And I also knew that 100 days wouldn't be enough to fill out an actual book. Yeah. But I didn't know what the end date of my, the terminus of my narrative would be. And so I just kept, I thought I was going to do a book about the first year. And then at the end of the first year, I knew that whatever judgment I would arrive at wouldn't really stand the test of time. And then I got to the end of the second year and the midterm elections, the success of the Ukrainian counteroffensive, and a raft of legislative accomplishments. And I thought, okay, I have a story that will stand up to history's judgment. You know, the next 2 years of the Biden presidency could undermine, to some extent, my judgment, not the accomplishments, but really the Biden presidency's long-term historical value depends on him essentially winning re-election in 2024. Because if he goes and does all these things, if he passes all this agenda, if he sets the country on a course towards clean energy and revives American manufacturing and revives our alliances abroad, all of that starts to crumble if Donald Trump returns to office.
Well, that's the real reason why he has to win election for to have a decent legacy. It's because the alternative very much seems like it will be Donald Trump. Okay, there was, though, at the end point that was thrust upon you, there was a gigantic question that I think made the Biden presidency at best a B-, and that was inflation. And even since then, inflation has seemed to be tamed. I want to focus our interview a little bit on inflation and economic policy. So let's go to the early days when he's combating COVID and he's hired Rachel Walensky, and there's good reporting in the book about how people hold her in high regard personally, but she's not good at running a bureaucracy and she causes a lot of problems for the administrations by her quick off-the-cuff announcements. Fine, we're going to cordon off the medical part of COVID. How badly does he want to do a Bernie Sanders style massive $6 trillion stimulus?
He badly wants to do it, in part because one of the keys to understanding Joe Biden is that he's this guy who's constantly been underestimated by everybody. When he was a senator, he was subjected to this plagiarism scandal, or subjected himself to a plagiarism scandal, mm-hmm. where people thought that he was incredibly plastic and superficial, that he didn't actually know anything. It was the staff feeding him these phony lines.
Right.
Then he's Obama's vice president and everybody rolls their eyes at him. He's the cornball with his muscle car, and he speaks in a funny sort of way and he hogs time. And then he's elected president and everybody assumes that he's going to be a placeholder president. And because this underestimation is the thing that propels him, he doesn't want to be a placeholder president. He wants to be an heir to Franklin Roosevelt. And so I think the thing that's most interesting about him, as opposed to doing the half measure, his tendency has been to go the full Monty, to go the biggest that he can possibly give. And in fact, his theory of the case, I think, was that he was willing to accept the risk of short-term inflation in order to keep people in their jobs. Because in his mm-hmm. his worldview, work is the source of all dignity, that unemployment is the worst thing that can happen to something, which is the view that's informed from his childhood when his father took a social tumble and was laid off for his job.
So there are economists, Lawrence Summers, described in your book as a frenemy of the administration, others who are saying you're stimulating the economy too much. There are people within his administration like Brian Deese, who has a chart he'd like to show you to show that this maybe isn't the case. There are progressives like Bernie Sanders and the squad who really have discounted the effect of the budget deficit. There's Joe Manchin, who seems to very much take it seriously. Where's Biden on all of this? Like, he comes in and there's this label centric. So you might think, and he's enacted legislation in the past to reduce the deficit, but does he, okay, you've established, he wants to go big, he wants to be FDR, but does he think, oh yeah, the deficit is a problem or can be a problem. Does he buy into, we've been so wrong about the deficit in the past? Does he say that, you know, we've been worried about inflation for the last 20 years, it's not going to happen? This is a multi-barreled question, but if you really sat him down at that point, I know he wanted to go big and pump money into the economy and thought that the Obama stimulus was too little, but what did he and his staff really think about the risks of the kind of inflation that really was a problem for him in the second half of your book?
I think he does care about deficits, but I think when he looks back at previous predictions about inflation, at least in recent decades, he sees how there are a lot of economists who he would probably regard as intellectual ninnies. I mean, he really is not a fan of economists at his core. And his relationship to Larry Summers is a super fascinating thing, because on the one hand, I think that he craves Larry Summers' respect and admiration. And on the other hand, Larry Summers is exactly the type of elite that Joe Biden doesn't especially care for, because he thinks that these elites think that they're smarter than he is. Mm-hmm. So he cares about deficits. I think he probably believes in his heart that the predictions about inflation are Chicken Little-ish, and so we don't need to take them super seriously because they haven't turned out in the last series of iterations. And so the benefits of going big outweigh whatever those harms are.
So when he went big with the American Rescue Act, and how much was that? How many trillion was that spending?
It was just short of two.
Okay, so almost $2 trillion worth of spending. And then there was inflation. And he and the administration, but he kept calling it transitory. To me, that's a tell that his actual, well, you would be able to tell me differently, that his actual opinion was, you know, this, that he meant it, that this is transitory and it's not going to, our stimulus didn't contribute long-term inflation. And then as inflation lasted longer and longer and longer, his public statements seemed to acknowledge that he was a bit wrong about it being transitory. My question being, at some point, did he and the key architects in his administration come to think of the American Rescue Plan as contributing to inflation?
I think maybe marginally, but there are a couple things to remember about that rescue plan. The first is the most inflationary part of it was that we were giving people checks.
Yes.
The government was writing people checks. And that was not something that he initially intended to do, but it was a campaign promise that he felt like he had to make to win the two Senate seats in Georgia. That was something where the political tides kind of brought him to this place. And it was a political gamble that obviously paid off, because the Democrats were able to take the Senate, and that changed the whole contours of his presidency because of that. And I would also say that I'm not actually sure about how economic historians will look back on this this round of inflation, because it actually may in the end be transitory, that it's fallen so much faster than the Larry Summers of the world thought it would.
I mean, part of it was the supply chain. Part of it was the war in Ukraine. And I do think that, well, not just Summers and Furman, but others were pointing to, you know, 2% of the 10%, maybe 2.5% of the 10% was cost of stimulus spending. And my question, and Furman was saying, we're doing too much. We're giving out checks after the economy is already stimulated. As you pointed out, that wasn't a Joe Biden preferred policy. But my question is, so they're facing the midterms. They don't know they're going to do all right. At that moment, did he regret anything he did?
Joe Biden is interesting because he doesn't express regret easily. Yeah. I mean, the signature example of this is the Afghanistan withdrawal, where he has elite opinion just bearing down on him, chastising him for making this decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. The administration looks pretty incompetent in the moment. And rather than casting blame and firing an aide or admitting that he'd made a mistake, he doubles down and believes that he was right. In the long run, that judgment may prove out. But he's somebody who has expressed regret over various things in the course of his career. He's said that he regretted passing the banking reform in the late 90s, the deregulatory reform.
Yeah,
I think he's obviously regretted the Obama stimulus ever since for being in but I don't think
that wasn't really his to regret. He regretted that his boss didn't go bigger and there's no guarantee you could have gotten it. And then he also at least apologized somewhat for his role in the Clarence Thomas hearings. But these are all things that it was politically necessary for him to regret them in later years. Like, these were positions he had to take. So that's why he would say, you know, I was wrong then, because not doing so would hurt him in the present.
Right. And by the time he got to the midterms, he'd also passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a badly named climate bill, but that also does contain deficit reduction in it. And so in his mind, at least, he'd done his bit to reduce the deficit.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that act. So to remind listeners, big stimulus up front that wasn't much objected to, and then the gears ground a little bit. There was an infrastructure bill on the table, and then there was the bigger Build Back Better, which could have been all this social spending. The theory advanced by progressives was the infrastructure bill is all that the moderates care about, so we have to not pass it in order to get our Build Back Better spending passed. They did not win, and infrastructure was passed. So at that point, tell me two questions about Joe Biden and his chief architects. A, did he really was he okay with that? And B, did he really think there'd be a chance to build back better? In other words, did he disagree with the progressives' theory of the case that Build Back Better, whatever you want to call that, was very embattled and endangered?
So I think he probably mostly agreed with the progressives that once the infrastructure bill passed, it almost certainly cost him leverage in his dealings with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, that they wanted, at least Sinema, especially Sinema, wanted the infrastructure bill, and proving that she could broker a bipartisan achievement was incredibly important to her. Manchin, I think, cared a little bit less about the infrastructure achievement. But in the end, in December of 2021, his presidency begins to crumble because right before Christmas, Joe Manchin freaks out about Build Back Better and goes on Fox News Sunday and basically throws up his hands and says, I've tried everything to get this over the line. It's just not going to happen. And at that point, it really did look like the any vision of passing transformational legislation was seriously dead. And Manchin left those negotiations with a lot of bad blood. Every time he would talk about Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, it was Ron effing Klain. And every time he dealt with the White House, he would just complain about how they thought they were smarter than him. And there was so much grievance there. And one of the hardest things for Joe Biden to do was to surrender playing Senate Majority Leader. He loves politics. He loves throwing himself into negotiations. He's got this swaggering sense of his own ability to negotiate with senators. And so the hardest thing for him to do was to shelve his ego and get out of the way and let Chuck Schumer manage the negotiations with Joe Manchin. And so one of the ironies is that the Inflation Reduction Act is the biggest achievement of the Biden presidency. And in the end,
Number two is it doesn't reduce inflation that much.
No,
but as you say, it is a huge climate act. A guy from West Virginia can't pass the Transforming Climate Act, but that's what he did.
Yeah, exactly. And that happened primarily because Joe Biden was willing to shelve his ego and get out of the way and let the senators carry it over the line.
Right. So we'll cut from that moment where Joe Manchin says, I'm out. It looks like AOC and the progressives, Bernie Sanders, are like, this is what we told you. You couldn't have. This is why we needed to hold the vote on inflation back to get what we wanted. But cut to a few months later, and they do get what's called the Inflation Reduction Act. How much spending and stimulus and social spending, everything else was in there versus what the ask was of Pramila Jayapal and the progressives?
So one of the ironies of the Inflation Reduction Act is that it could maybe spend endlessly, that when Joe Manchin passed the bill, much to his own regret, there was no cap on the amount that the government can spend on tax credits and subsidies for clean energy. And so they thought that they were going to be spending about $370 billion on clean energy. But in the end, it's going to end up being well over $1 trillion, I think. And
yeah,
based on all the initial evidence, companies are moving to take advantage of this much more quickly than anybody anticipated, because it's a great freaking deal for companies. And so the transition to clean energy is actually happening much more quickly than really anyone could have possibly anticipated. But even still, it is a shadow of what Bernie Sanders dreamed of getting. I mean, they had dreamed of getting about realistically, they were dreaming of getting about $3 trillion worth of spending. And there's nothing that Joe Biden has done in the course of his presidency to really expand the social safety net, which is the conventional standard that people use for judging whether a Democratic presidency has been successful or not. Politically, I think it's maybe the most capacious version of the Democratic agenda that could have emerged. There's no, for better or for worse, there's no economic redistribution that's happened. There's been no expansion of the welfare state. The thing that you have is all of this spending on reviving American manufacturing. And some of it's done towards progressive ends, like battling climate change, or in the CHIPS bill, which subsidizes semiconductor production. There's some incentives, there's some requirements that force companies to spend on childcare in exchange for receiving this government largesse.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, it's very hard for conservatives to target this legislation for repeal, because it's all, at least on paper, immensely popular.
If he had the votes, would Joe Biden — it wasn't just Sinnerman Manchin, there were other senators who would certainly vote against $3 trillion in spending. In fact, those senators probably like the fact that Manchin and Sinema are out there taking the arrows on this one. But do you think Joe Biden would have happily signed the bill that spent $3 trillion?
Well, happily, yes. And in the end, when it was all negotiated, it was about $2 trillion. It was probably a little bit less than $2 trillion. And he had, in essence, gotten Sinema and Manchin on board with that spending. It was so close to happening. And it wasn't a radical bill at that point. It subsidized universal kindergarten, pre-K. It did some stuff to expand elder care and daycare. It introduced some, I think, benefits that on paper would have proven pretty popular, but it wasn't like it was a shift to single payer healthcare that was happening.
So here's my theory, and I am going to check myself because I am a centrist moderate, and that's not just labels. That's how I kind of look at the world and think that it's mostly right. I think it really, really worked out well. I think if Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders had totally gotten their way, inflation would have been a lot higher, so much higher that the midterms might well have been a disaster, even with everything else that was happening. Plus, inflation is really bad for people. So I think that amount of spending would have had an inflationary impact. The fact that all of this didn't go smoothly, according to a Cori Bush wish list, meant that there was a limit on stimulus and spending, meaning that inflation was kept enough under control that it could come down now. But what did happen is we got the infrastructure bill, which probably helped the Democrats in the midterms, and we got this transformative climate bill. So given — and this was no one's grand scheme, people were on board, people were off board, Schumer and Manchin had this huge dance and their staffs — but I do think that it worked out really well for a kind of a best case scenario for America. And I also think that the squad and maybe just the squad or the squad plus voting against infrastructure and voting against the ultimate Inflation Reduction Act in the House was bordering on shameful, but certainly shows that their theory of the case was not borne out. That's what I think. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't think there would have been much short-term inflationary effect from the Build Back Better legislation. The way that the programs were structured, a lot of them would have taken time to kick in. I think that you're correct in arguing that that Biden's instincts are towards bipartisanship. And one of the things that he's never going to get any credit for, because people don't actually love bipartisanship, even though they all say that they want it, is that he's made the Senate and he's made institutions function in a genuinely bipartisan sort of way. He's passed all of this legislation that just breaks recent patterns. And whether it was the CHIPS bill, it was the gun legislation, whether it was the burn pit legislation or the NATO expansion, these are all things that the Senate had struggled to pass. And it was a closely divided Senate, and he managed to allow a coalition of senators in the middle to actually run the institution. I think that he has one question that I think is impossible to answer is how has you began this interview by saying that Biden is essentially boring, that the figure that he cuts on television is one of an old man who's got no energy, who doesn't seem like a domineering presence in our political life. And the fact that we've had a relatively boring president who most people consider to be an incidental part of their lives may actually have helped lower the temperature in this country.
Yeah.
And
that was actually something he was implicitly promising as well.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, it's a question. Like, has the political temperature actually lowered in this country? I think it probably has in some sort of meaningful sort of way. It doesn't feel like we're on the brink of a civil war right now, even though all of these indictments are proceeding. And I think that the culture war continues apace, but some of these issues feel a lot less fraught than they did a couple years ago.
Okay, we'll put a pin in this one right here, right now. And tomorrow, Frank will be back to discuss why Biden didn't offer Bernie Sanders a cabinet position, how he negotiated with Kevin McCarthy, and how Biden's age just might be an asset. All right, some of these are more stretched than the others, but that's tomorrow. And now the spiel. You know which airline never had a crash, right? What, you haven't seen the 1989 Best Picture winner?
Qantas. What, Qantas?
Qantas never crashed.
Qantas?
Never crashed.
But now Qantas's CEO has crashed out. Sorry, make that cashed out. Depending on which Australian tabloid you read, it seems that many Australians are upset with the outgoing boss of the carrier with the kangaroo on its tail and the perfect safety record. The CEO of the Flying Kangaroo, as they call the carrier, Alan Joyce, is retiring a couple months early, and he was somewhat forced out. Critics criticize his pay. Some Australians are up in arms, cuddly koala arms, over the fact that Qantas tried to keep rival airline Qatar out of Australia. And the airline does or did sell a bunch of tickets for flights that were canceled during COVID. They sold them after they were canceled and should have known they were canceled. And there's this to quote Reuters. The granting of a premium airport lounge membership to Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's son and its opposition to Qatar Airways adding additional flights to Australia have led to many recent newspaper headlines and editorials in the country. Now, I have a quibble and a qualifier as to the Qantas and Qatar querulousness. First, the quibble. It's about Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. I'm an Italian-American. I'm interested, perhaps rooting a little bit for the success of my fellow Italians, Italian-Australians, though they may be. My problem is with how the Australians pronounce the name. Let's play an ABC, that's the Australian broadcasting clip, about all of this.
But the Albanese government has been accused of being too close to Qantas.
Their failure to answer basic questions time and time again on the real reason they blocked the Qatar Airways application shows that there are questions to answer, that there is something not quite right.
Qantas yesterday acknowledged its reputation had been, quote, hit hard on several fronts. The company says it understands the public's disappointment and promises to do better.
My qualifier, remember the quibble and the qualifier about Qantas? The qualifier is these scandals to me, an American, who is used to truly, truly shitty American air service, they seem kind of minor. Qantas is facing charges they sold seats on flights that were canceled. But don't you U.S. carriers do that as a matter of course. That's the business model, selling seats they don't have. And then they invent a somewhat Orwellian phrase like overbooking to explain it. And they program the downtime at the gate with anyone willing to take a flight a little later for a $300 voucher. Okay, $500 voucher. All right, $700 and upgrade to shrimp cocktail after takeoff. That's all baked in. It's nothing. I don't know. It doesn't seem like a scandal to me. Qantas made a record $2.3 billion or $1.7 billion after taxes. Now, that's Australian billion, but an American billion, it's still a billion. It's like $1.1 billion. It was a record. It's a hugely profitable airline, one of the most profitable and successful businesses in Australia. And it was a huge turnaround, COVID doing what it did to decimate the Australian and all international air travels. So, yeah. The CEO of Qantas got paid. Alan Joyce's yearly compensation is $2.2 million. All right, record profits. Keep that in mind. Here are some U.S. CEOs' compensation. Scott Kirby, American Airlines, $9.8 million. Ed Bastian, CEO of Delta, $9.6 million. John Redmond of Allegiant Air, $8.55 million. Now, at this point, I should note that maybe living in the U.S., with its habits of corporate impunity, has inured me, has warped me. I have read all the allegations about Joyce and Qantas that they got $1 billion in tax credits during COVID and didn't pay it back. As an American, I squinted a little when I heard that. Pay it back? Why would a company pay it back? I read about Joyce's 24 million Australian retirement package, and I thought, why wouldn't the CEO of a hugely successful company who's been on the job for 15 years, why wouldn't he make 24 million, which is, by the way, 15 million American? A million a year? That seems okay. I mean, it's a lot of money, a million a year. Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander each made $43 million last year, and the Mets traded them away, not because they were good, but because they sucked. Unlike Qantas, the Mets have crashed. No one in the international business press, or Australia, anywhere in Australia, seems to agree with me. To quote Bloomberg, Joyce's successor's, quote, premature succession shows an airline bowing to public anger over the alleged sale last year of seats on flights that were never going to take off. The scandal, the latest in a series of blows to Qantas's reputation in recent months, has been amplified by the airline's record-breaking profits. Amplified? Your service sucked and you made a lot of money? In America, it's, well, your service sucks, you rip off the customer, but hell, you make a lot of money. Good for you, buddy. There, but for the grace of God and a layover in Adelaide, go I. But the Australian media was not buying it.
It's not the flying kangaroo, it's the gouging kangaroo.
Ooh, Kanga's got claws. Rear! Sorry, not rear. You know what sound an Australian kangaroo, which is to say a kangaroo makes? They go like this. You don't believe me? Here it is. Here's a kangaroo. Actual kangaroo sound. That is the world's phlegmiest animal. A little too much dairy in the blintzes. Kangaroo. But that is what a kangaroo sounds like. Here's what an outgoing CEO testifying before the Australian Parliament sounds like. The first voice you'll hear in this exchange is Labour MP Tony Sheldon, who was once head of Australia's Transportation Workers Union.
So, Senator, don't you feel embarrassed?
So, Senator,
because I tell you what, I'd feel embarrassed if I was you.
Before COVID, we had record profits, record levels of customer satisfactions. We were one of the most trusted companies in the country. COVID knocked us for six. COVID's knocked us for six, Senator, and it knocked every other airline in the
Mr.
world.
Joyce, you are the most complained company in Australia.
Through a period
You're
of...
trying to say to me that there's no problem here.
I'm not.
You know, what can you say to that other than to quote the grounded kangaroo? And that's it for the show. The Gist was produced by Corey Wara, and the senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is the chief kangaroo officer of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Jeeperu, kangaroo, and thanks for listening.